Okay, we are beginning. This is our Derech Hashem class number 35. Number 34 didn't record well, and I'll try to re-record that. But if anybody does want to listen to that recording, my voice begins 22 minutes into it when I switched phones. So just download it and slide the bar forward to minute 22 if somebody wants to hear that. But I'll try to redo it if I can. Okay, we're in section 2. Chapter 8, paragraph 3. Where did it go? Okay, we're in the middle of paragraph 3, in the paragraph that starts regarding. Regarding any particular creation, its very essence, as well as its nature, depend on a highly designed mixture which combines these many qualities. So let's just review for a second these many qualities. One paragraph back. The influence of God's illumination thus results in such qualities as advantage, which we call ribui, clarity, which is zakus, value, which is yakar. The concealment of his light, on the other hand, brings about disadvantage, chisaron, or opaqueness, avius, and worthlessness, shiflus. Excuse me. Regarding any particular creation, everything is mixed. It all depends on a highly designed mixture which combines these many qualities. For each thing is a structured combination of individual components. And in the member components, there can be elements of advantage and disadvantage, and elements of clarity and opaqueness, elements of value and lack of value. The influences, which are the roots of each creation, must therefore be a mix of both the revelations of God's light and the withholding of it. The twofold influence being transmitted through the ordained system along channels and in degrees that are appropriate until the creation which contains the influences materializes in its desired state of being, having its intended character traits and limitations. This is an important principle which pertains to the existence of all things as well as every event everywhere. So let's just think for a minute. Let's just think about a child born into a family. Right, so in terms of the revelation of Hashem's light and the concealment at the same time and how they mix in so many different ways into that child, let's say the child has difficult parents that are not loving or don't provide everything that's necessary, or just provide it to a certain degree. There's very few parents who provide nothing necessary, and there's very few parents who provide everything necessary, right? So you have different degrees of what parents provide. And then you have different degrees inside the personality of the child in order to receive that which is provided. Just even in thinking about the word, the sentence, let's say, I love you, right? So let's say parents are providing. They can say I love you to a one-year-old who can't understand it because they don't have language yet. They feel the feelings, but they don't know the sentence. An eight-year-old understands it very differently. A 15-year-old probably tosses it off. They understand it differently. A 22-year-old understands it differently, and so does a 30-year-old who's now a parent understand the I love you of a parent very differently, right? So it has to do with what the parent is transmitting as well as what the child has the kalim, has the tools to be able to receive both together. And the kalim of the child, the tools of the child, are a mixture of the revelation and the withholding of Hashem's light. And so is the parent's ability to send the message, a mixture of the revelation and the withholding of Hashem's light. And then the environment that they both dwell within is a mixture of the revelation and the withholding of Hashem's light. And so everything is a mixture of the revelation and the withholding in different degrees, which creates each thing, each instance, each creature, each person, every event, everywhere, is many different streams of revelation and withholding. Right? Does that make sense so far? So we have all these character traits, the ribui, the zakus, the yakar, the advantage, the clarity, the value is as revelation, and then the disadvantage, the opaqueness, the worthlessness, all those things mixed together in different ways to create each individual thing. So there's rules for that revelation and withholding. Hashem has natural rules of the world. And then there's also, as we mentioned before in earlier classes, Hashem's ability to transcend the rules. Even though he set up the rules and he wants to work by the rules, he's not stuck inside the rules. He can do whatever he wants. it's all for a certain aim. So just like, let's say, a parent, again, would set up rules. There's bedtime, right? You have to go to bed on time. But this week, I don't know, it's fireworks, right? It's the 4th of July. That doesn't work for you, Javi, because you live in England. But but let's say something.
November.
So there's fireworks, and I, as a parent, make a choice that what I want you to, what's most important is that you should grow up happy and healthy, which means, in general, a regular bedtime. But in this case, I can transcend the bedtime as a parent and say going and having that community experience of seeing the fireworks and feeling good with other people is the way to get you to feeling happy and healthy, more important than the regular bedtime. It's worth losing the sleep over that fun experience. So Hashem can do that too. He has his regular rules. He wants to work inside the rules, and he has an ultimate goal, which sometimes will require him to step outside the rules that he set up. Okay, any questions on that before we continue to the next paragraph? I think we did a lot of setting up of that in the previous classes. Do you have any thoughts or questions you want to share? No?
No.
Okay, on to four. When we look at the world in general, at its history since creation, and when we read the predictions of the prophets, we recognize that humanity itself passes through four different basic states of being. In this respect, the history of mankind is very much like the life of an individual, for as an individual is born and grows to maturity, so too the human race. So this is interesting, just thinking about the mashal that we just gave of, let's say, a child receiving the I love you in different ways depending on their stages of development and their ability to understand what I love you means. So too, humanity is moving through different states of development, which we're going to see inside here, but we could even just think about our Western civilization moving through different states, experimenting with different types of government or different economic setups to try to create the best position. It's even interesting to think about, you know, lately meaning the last couple hundred years, 300 years, we've tried different forms of government, you know, discovering democracy or trying a different type of democracy than Greek democracy, trying the American democracy, moving away from monarchy, trying out socialism and communism, big failures, but trying different ways to create the collective best, or at least to sell it as a collective best. And Javi, just so you know, we have somebody who comes from Russia in the room, so like she has experience with that.
Oh, wow.
But even the concept that we care about a collective best is a new concept, really, in the history of the world. I mean, it's a Jewish concept, right, that we want to bring the world to a perfected state, but that governments would care about more than the government, right? I mean, that's what the Magna Carta was about, right, that kings are subject to the rule of God, that there's a law above the law that kings can make. But that was pretty revolutionary as a concept. And then the Western civilizations, whether they experimented with failed experiments or not, they're still working with even the EU as an experiment, trying to create something that will work for the betterment of all, right, instead of just the betterment of those who are in charge. And we're still struggling with that. We still see in Africa, it's often the person who's in charge who is making it, who it betters. It's not bettering, you know, the people who are in the mines or the people who are separating out all the toxic chemicals from everything we think we're recycling responsibly, and all the children in India are becoming, you know, getting toxic from everything, you know, all our cell phones that we put in the recycle box and that unscrupulous recycle companies take to India and have children separate out. Right, so it's just bettering the people who are in charge. Nevertheless, there is this concept now that we hold in the Western world, which really does come from Torah, that we should be looking out for everybody. And there should be a system that makes everybody's life better, which would be laughable 500 years ago. It wasn't really about how you can make everybody's life better. It was just about how to make mine better, I think, right? Does that jive with your understanding of history? Just in terms of, I don't know if there was a concept of taking care of the nation, the peasants. The peasants were there to serve the people that they served rather than that they should be happy.
was the responsibility of people who had more to share, for sure. That comes from the Torah.
But do you think that was an expectation outside of religion, let's say?
There was
as
no
a societal?
Outside of religion.
Right, there was no outside
that.
Of religion, right. I'm just trying to think. I mean, I don't know enough about Muslim culture and Arab lands to think about. I don't even know enough, but I could just ask the question. I just wonder, was there a sense of responsibility by the kings or the princes of Arab tribes to make sure that those under them had what they needed? I just don't know. Anyway, I would say that there we can see some development. You know, there is the self-centeredness of childhood. There is the all-knowingness of young adulthood, of late teenhood and young adulthood, where you know it all, and everybody older than you is just stupid, until you get older enough to realize that you didn't know it all and they actually have what to say on the world. Those are different stages of human development, and we'll see now as we look at this paragraph that there are different stages of development of all humanity. So we have different stages within our own development, but humanity is also developing, and we'll see where it's headed. But it's interesting to see that these stages of development, as the Ramchal expresses them, are out of order from individual human development. But let's look at this now. The first state was one where ignorance and darkness prevailed among mankind, and true knowledge of God and his perfection were greatly obscured. Our sages call this period the 2,000 years of desolation. So that's from creation to Abraham. Basically, that's 2,000 years. Remember, Abraham was born in 1948 from the year zero of creation. From our current count of 5773, Abraham was born in 1948, which is easy to remember because that's the establishment of the State of Israel. Not for Javi because you're Hasidic, so you probably didn't know that. But but 1948 is the State of Israel, and in the current count of 2012, and 1948 in our current count of 5773 is when Abraham was born. So that initial 2,000 years is called the 2,000 years of desolation. The second state is somewhat better and is the one in which we now live. We have knowledge of both the existence and perfection of God. His Torah is available to us, and we can thus serve him. Still, we live in a time when there is neither sign nor prophet, and the true enlightenment of divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh, is lacking. Even though man can gain very much knowledge through his own intellect and human endeavor, this cannot be compared to what he can gain through the spiritual inspiration granted by God. The two are as different as the body and the soul. So it's hard for us to imagine the difference because we've never had connection with real Ruach HaKodesh. Excuse me, and we have like little bits that blow through our lives, but not the same thing as somebody who can really teach us from that place or help us understand the world with Ruach HaKodesh. But in a way, we could use the mashal of learning something on our own and learning something with the teacher. You know, it's very different to, let's say, try to figure out even how to cook in your kitchen. Right? It's so much different when somebody shows you, oh, this is how you roll a fondant frosting. This is how you make that roast. This is how you cook with less oil but don't burn it. This is how you can tell when the edges of the pancake are done and it's time to flip it. Right? You could learn it on your own, or somebody can show you. Excuse me, and it works much faster. So that's sort of what's going on. We have a lot. We can do a lot with our own brain and our own heart and our own soul. But it's just not the same as when somebody comes in with so much more of the Ruach HaKodesh to be able to bring us to a higher place. And it's so different that we can't really imagine it here. It's saying the two are as different as the body and the soul. Now, so that's the state that we live in now. And the third state, so in terms of progression, this is the third state, but in terms of our human experience, this state came second. The third state is still better. And this is the state that existed while the Holy Temple stood. During this period, there were wonders and miracles, and prophecy could be found among men and women. Prophetic inspiration, however, was not granted to all mankind, but only to a select few. Such inspiration was furthermore very difficult even for such persons to attain, for there were things preventing one from attaining it and otherwise holding it back. So we have the state that we have now where we can do a lot with our souls but not and our minds, but we don't have Ruach HaKodesh. Then we have the third state where we're really living in much more connection with Hashem. We have Ruach HaKodesh to help guide us. We have people who are prophets. And we'll see when we learn more about prophecy in the next section that prophecy influences not just the prophet, but all of us, because we're all connected to each other. So, so in a way, if we understand prayer more deeply, and we can understand that the prayer of one affects the other, not just because one is praying for the other, but because the holiness that is gained in prayer and guarded in prayer is gained for the klal, is gained for the whole community of Jews and affects all Jews. I mean, that's part of why we pay for, part of why we, I don't know about you, Javi, but because your husband learns on a regular basis, but let's say we, whose husbands do not learn on a regular basis, we will contribute to institutions where men are learning full-time, because we want to have a share in them learning, and we understand that that learning, done correctly, done deeply, helps us too. So we share our resources, and they share theirs. They share their spiritual resources with, not just with us individually, but it does affect the community. So the same thing with prophecy.
Any spiritual act, really.
Any spiritual act, definitely, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think about. Rav Kook certainly was big in this, and not everybody holds by him, but he felt very strongly that even the Chiloni, even the non-religious Jew in the land of Israel, building up the land of Israel, the kibbutznik who ate treif and was machal Shabbos, but was settling the land for Jews to live in the land, was contributing to the klal as a spiritual act, even if he didn't have kavana, because those of us here in Chutz La'aretz, living outside the land, outside the law that pertains to the land, we can't keep all those mitzvot, but we yearn to. So, excuse me, our kavana can go with his action. His action can complete our kavana. And we are together. We're part of one klal. And so we do, there is a partnership in the root of who we are as a spiritual people. So he, therefore, Rav Kook, therefore, saw Kedusha in the Chiloni, which I think is probably the wave of the future, to see that ahava-based participation in the community, see the holiness in each person, and try not to see the klipa that's holding it back. You know, it's so easy for us to judge and look at the negative that people are doing rather than seek out the kernels of good that people are doing. And I think Rav Kook was excellent at that, like looking for what's good in each person and bringing that forward. Okay, so that's the third state, which we experienced before the state they were in, and now the fourth state. So the fourth state is the very best. And this is the state that the prophets predicted for the ultimate future. This will be a time when folly will cease to exist completely. Divine inspiration will be poured out on all mankind and will be attained without any difficulty whatsoever. So it's difficult for us to think about, you know, how hard we work to create a connection with Hashem, to achieve any knowledge of Hashem. And the fourth state where we know that the future is referred to, Umalachal Ha'aretz Deya, that the world will be filled with the knowledge of God. It'll be so obvious to everyone. It'll be like the sun shining. You won't have to say it. There'll be no more convincing. And, in fact, there'll be no need for a place like I'm sitting in right now, the Jewish Experience and Outreach Center in Denver, Colorado, and other outreach places, Kiruv, around the world. There won't be a need for it, because it will be so obvious that all of that teaching won't be necessary. Not only will it be so obvious, there'll be no more convince me teaching necessary, but there also won't be any more, now that I'm convinced, teach me about it teaching necessary. Now, I don't understand all of that. And frankly, as a Torah teacher, it's a little daunting to think about a world in which my chief love won't be needed to teach. So I don't know exactly what that's going to be like. But it will be a place, I guess, where we're all working with the knowledge that we have to grow in that. So it's hard to imagine, you know, what it could be like when folly ceases to exist completely. Folly can be fun, but I guess not the negative folly, or it could just be distracting. and again, divine inspiration would be poured out on all mankind, not all Jews. It says here all mankind, and will be attained without any difficulty. So right now we have so many blocks in the way, whether it's our brain chemistry, whether it's our parnasa, whether it's our family members, whether it's our government, whether it's the prevailing notions of the society around us, right? All those things can block us from feeling connected to Hashem, from wanting to do Hashem's will, from growing ourselves spiritually. All of that will be lifted. And it'll just be us and Hashem, we're able to move forward without all those blocks. So that's the Messianic era. When all the blocks are lifted, we still are working, but we're working in a different way to increase our connection to Hashem without all those blocks. And back in the text, at this time, humanity will be considered to have attained full maturity. From then on, mankind will experience constant elevation and will delight in God forever and ever. So it's a pretty interesting thing to think about. I mean, here we are today, not delighting in God so much as a group. Some religious niche group are, but not so much as a human group. What were you going to say, Yana?
This stage is what we understand as Olam Haba.
No, this stage I think is the Messianic stage.
Messianic.
Mm-hmm. So it's still a stage here because we'll still be growing. It's mankind. We'll experience constant elevation. So we will delight in God forever. And it was meant, that stage was meant to transition into Olam Haba. Like we talked about in our earlier class today, how candle lighting, right, is like death, in that when we light candles, we make that transition from the week into Shabbos. So from the time of putting effort into the world, into the time of living inside that effort. So when we light candles, we don't go through a huge transformation. We just transition up into the status of Shabbos. Unlike death, where we go through a huge transformation, right? It seems like we cease to function and then we're buried in the ground and we decompose and soul goes one place and body has to go through what it must and then we're put back together for the Olam Haba experience. But it was initially supposed to be just like Shabbos, that we should go from this world to the next world just like that with no big interruption, no big traumatic something. You just basically light candles and start the next phase. So that's what it's supposed to be. So I don't know, and we don't have clarity on all the transmission about Mashiach and what's going to happen when Mashiach comes. But I would think that when Mashiach is here and we're in this state, that you won't need to die then. Like anybody who has died already will be able to be resurrected and live partly in the Messianic time, which is pre-Olam Haba. But it seems like, I think, that those who are alive or born into Messianic times will not have to go through death, but just be able to transition, like for Shabbos, right into the Olam Haba phase.
There might be a special generation of people who deserve not to die, right?
Right, but it's a different, so what is, but death is about the disassociation with, even aging. I mean, Tzipora Heller talks about aging, how the aging process is about disassociation with the physical. So as you, when you're born and as you get older and more beautiful, stronger and more capable into your 20s, right? So you're very much defined about who you are. As a matter of fact, you come into deeper definition of self through the physical in your teenage years. It's less when you're a child. You don't even realize necessarily how connected you are to your body. Then in your teenage years, as you discover, you know, your power to attract a little bit, and depending on how you're educated, either you're flaunting that power to attract or you're withholding that power to attract, but you're certainly in relationship with that power to attract in some way, whether it's through repression or expression, right, in those teenage years. But you continue to get stronger and smarter and more capable as you come into early adulthood, so you do define yourself in all those ways of how great you are through your physical abilities, and then they start to fall away. Right, slowly the eyesight deteriorates a little bit and your tummy's not as tight as it was, you have a couple of kids and whatever, and then your hair isn't as pretty as it was, and then your skin gets a little bit wrinkly, and then you're not as strong. You find one day that it's hard to lift that heavy pot onto the top shelf where you keep it, and you realize you should find a lower place to put it, or whatever it is. Like slowly your balance isn't as good. You worry when you step on the top of an escalator. You know, you want to make sure that you are holding on instead of just stepping on like you used to. Whatever it is, like slowly, and it gets worse as you get older, your physical abilities fall away, and that whole process is about learning how to define self through who you are, not through what your body is, right? That because eventually you're getting to the place where you're going to leave your body behind and move on completely, just you. And the body so disintegrates that it goes into the ground and completely disintegrates. But first we live in it during that disintegration process. So it's just interesting to think about how, right, so the generation that requires death, that won't require death. So that generation that won't require death won't require it because they won't need that disassociation process. It's not necessarily a punishment, right? So when Hashem punishes, he's not always, he's almost, he never punishes just because he's mad. That's not it, right? Punishments are always about getting us to the right place. So to us, it feels like a punishment, but it's not really. So why did we get kicked out of the garden? Because we had to learn how to achieve closeness in a different pathway. So if we have to achieve that closeness in a different pathway, so Hashem gave us ways to work on that closeness. So for men, they have to work on achieving a parnasa by the sweat of their brow. Interesting to see that today that curse in a way is being lifted. Very few of our men anyway have to physically sweat to make a parnasa. Right? They still, everybody still has to work hard. And it's also fascinating to see the paradox of how much money we have and how poor we all feel. You know, like everybody, we're living better than anybody lived for the last several thousand years, you know, so much food in our house and so much warmth in our homes and so hot and cold running water and clothes and like we have everything. And yet we're all feel pressed for money. Even rich people feel pressed for money. Even rich people are living hand to mouth. It's amazing to see people are making $500,000 a year, $1 million a year. They live in homes that cost that, you know, and if they would not work for 1 month, they would lose their house. Because they don't have the money to pay the mortgage. And look, they're not living below their means. Everybody's living to the edge that pushes them hard. Anyway, but that's all about creating the pathway for us to accomplish what we're supposed to accomplish. So once we don't need disassociation from the physical, we won't need death. Right? So the generation, it's not that the generation that will be so special that they're born into a world where they're so special they don't need to die. It's that the reality will have changed to the extent through the collective human experience and engagement with the divine that that generation that's going to be born in the era of Mashiach isn't going to need the pathway of death and disassociation of the breakdown of the physical in order to figure out who they really are at their core. Because they'll know it.
Which means that the physical will be spiritual?
The physical won't be in the way of the spiritual. Right now it's in the way of it. It will support it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But now it's often in the way. It's interesting with the inner Torah work to work on using the physical to gain access to who we are in our fullness. But still, often the physical is in the way of the spiritual. I mean, that's why we try on Yom Kippur for one day to be as not physical as possible for that day of deep connection. So we don't do those five physical things just to try to act like a malach because the physical in general is in our way in achieving spirituality. It's the gateway, but it's also in our way. It's very distracting. However, we do know that the holiest day of the year, there's this vort on the holiest day of the year, is not Yom Kippur, because you can take the K of Kippur. K, in this case, really, K of Kippur is part of the root, Kapara, Kapara. But there is a vort on it that you can take the Kaf and make it like or as prefix, the Kaf means like or as. So if you say Yom Kippurim, so it's a day that's like Purim. Right, so Purim is the day with the most physical mitzvahs, which include eating and partying and dressing differently and getting drunk even, right? So really partying, but that's considered if you can do it right, if the physical doesn't distract you, then the physical is such a strong gateway to spirituality that Purim could be the holier day than Yom Kippur. But the challenge is how distracting the physical can be, and usually is. Very few people can figure out a way to make the spiritual a gateway, the physical a gateway to the spiritual all the time. Often the physical gets in the way. Many people can vacillate between the two. It can be a gateway, it can get in the way, it can be distracting, it can help. But hopefully during this time, this fourth state, be a time when the physical only serves to help us achieve the spiritual that we're supposed to achieve and isn't a distraction. Okay. Any more questions on that for now?
No.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Let's move to the fifth paragraph. Terrific. Okay. The influence that God grants to man spiritually is also circumscribed by time, place, and other considerations. So we were just discussing, let's just differentiate here, we're just discussing the physical, right? The physical reality of everything is a combination of God's revelation and God's concealment in different ways. But here now we're talking about spirituality. The influence that God grants to man spiritually is also circumscribed by time, place, and other considerations. God thus decreed and arranged things so that in certain ways more should be revealed in some specific times than in others. The same is also true of particular places, where more is revealed in one place than another. There are many aspects and details involved in this, all determined with the utmost precision according to what is most suitable for the rectification of creation as a whole. The particular sanctity surrounding certain special days as well as holy places is associated with this principle. In all these cases, a greater spiritual influence is extended to man, and he can attain more light, merit, and excellence according to a predetermined degree. Okay, so let's go back for a minute. So the fact that time, place, and other considerations helps open up the ability to connect to Hashem. So there's places that connect more and places that disconnect more. I forgot which Rebbe it was who was visiting New York probably in the 40s, getting money for his institution. But he had a driver, and they were driving through Times Square. And as they drove through Times Square, and Times Square then is very different than now. It's been cleaned up quite a bit now. But probably from 15 years ago and before, it was such a makom tuma. It's still a makom tuma. But it was such a tumidic place before that. I mean, prostitution and drugs and just and crime and just a horrible place. But, of course, an attractive place for those interested in the lights of Broadway and et cetera. But a place filled with tuma. And even though this Rebbe wasn't driving and even though he was looking down, whatever he was, he smelled it. And he said, "Where are we?" He exclaimed about the smell. He said, "What is that smell?" He smelled the tuma of it. So there are places that are tumidic places, places that have more tuma and places that have more kedusha. Obviously, we have the Kotel. We go to Kivrei Tzadikim, to the graves of Tzadikim, to daven, whether they're in Eretz Yisrael or outside of Eretz Yisrael. So we know that certain graves have levels of holiness. We know that certain buildings have levels of holiness. We know that certain cities, right? We have four holy cities in Judaism. We have Hebron and Yerushalayim and Tzfat and Tveria, I think is the fourth one, yeah. So we have those four holy cities on different levels. And that we know that we have times in the year, which we'll talk about in a minute, but we also have times in history where different things are revealed. So we have the time of the Kabbalists in Tzfat. That was the time for the revelation of that type of Kabbalah. And it wasn't before that. It wasn't the time to have that level of revelation before that. We have the time of in the Sephardic lands, the revelation of more of the piyutim, the ability to write liturgical poetry. We didn't have that. That wasn't part of it wasn't part of Jewish practice to have liturgical poems. Before that era when it flowered in the Mediterranean among the Sephardic writers. And it did spill a drop into the Ashkenaz lands, but it was mostly a Sephardic thing, the Sephardic Chachamim, who wrote that liturgical poetry. Some of that, you might say that the physical reason for some of that is that the Muslims love language, love words, and love poetry. They love to philosophize. They're very into philosophy and discussion of philosophy. So physically, you could see a reason being that we lived, the Sephardim, lived in a Muslim society where words were delightful and where people enjoyed the word play, whether it was talking in philosophy or whether it was writing poetry that expressed certain things. It was an area that delighted the people of the environment in which the Jews dwelled, and some of that spilled over into the Jews. So that would be a physical reason for more poetry at that time. But the spiritual reason is that Hashem opened up a window of poetry in the Jewish people at that time, that we were able to take certain concepts, let's say Yigdal, right, taking the 13 principles of faith and turning them into a poem that expressed them so beautifully, right? That wasn't something that the Ashkenazim were doing regularly, but that's something that the Sephardim did. But it was a whole era of poetry. But we see that with other things too. You know, how smart were the Greeks and the Romans? Look at their architecture. Amazing, right? They created huge things. Look at, I don't know who built the Hagia Sophia. Do you know who built that in Istanbul? A beautiful, huge domed, at first it was a church and now it's a mosque. I think it might be the biggest unsupported dome in the ancient world. And it's still there today, still stands today. It's lovely. How did they build that? And yet they didn't create computers. It had the math. Right, they had a lot of the science that we're using today, but the window was not yet opened for that. I mean, think about classical music, right? The Greeks and the Romans also loved performance, they loved music, they loved poetry, but they did not have the instruments that came later, not because they didn't have the technology, right? The same technology existed in the Middle Ages as they did in Greco-Roman times. Not like they had new tools, but a window opened that allowed that kind of classical music to flow into the world. And the same thing with science, the whole Industrial Revolution and what it's led to today, it's a window that opened. It's not that human beings are smarter today than they were then. It's that Hashem did open up a certain shefa, a flow of the ability to tap into something. And it's fascinating to think about how we went through the Industrial Revolution, and then I don't know what's in between that and now, but now we're talking about the knowledge generation, right? We're knowledge workers. What is that? If you ask me, you know, we all sit behind a computer and we call that productive work and we all get paid for it. It's unbelievable. You know, like, who's in the field? But even the people who are in the field are using computers to produce more of everything, right? So we need fewer people working in fields and more people behind computers, but it's a knowledge worker's age. Yes, a lot of people are wasting time. And what's happening is we're moving into an age of dat, right? Umalachol ha'aretz deya, where we're increasing our brain's capacity to learn, to think, to know, and we're increasing that all across the world so that when the knowledge of Hashem opens up and spills into the world, we'll all have brains that are developed to be able to receive it. I hope. I mean, that's what I see, you know, that we're moving into an era of more brain and less back across the world. So we still have plenty of people who work with their backs across the world, but we're definitely moving into an era of brain work, which is moving out of the curse of Adam into a whole new phase of humanity. You could see it unfolding. So that's particular times in history, and then thinking about the times of the year. So when Hashem, if you just imagine Hashem speaking to the soul and saying, okay, holy soul, I'm going to send you into a physical world. You're going to live in a physical body. So we all know from different tales that the soul shudders at the thought, what? You're going to send me into a physical world? That's not where I belong. You know, there's all kinds of Hasidic stories about that's like the princess living in the shack with the woodsman. You know, how do you send somebody from the palace into a rustic shack with a crass husband who hasn't developed the sensitivities that the princess is used to? And that's like the soul living in the body, living in this world. So what Hashem said is, okay, you do need to go into the world. You do have to live in that crass environment of physicality, in a physical body, in a physical world. But what I'm going to do is set up Kedusha stations for you. I'm going to set up oases in time for you to connect deeply and strongly back to your root so you won't get lost, so you won't forget where you come from, so you'll always keep your goal in mind of what you're trying to do here. And so a seventh of our time is Shabbos, right? One day every week is a holy day. But more than that, we have Yontif also. And if you add up all Shabboses and all Yontifs, you get one-fifth of our year is spent in holy days. And then it's interesting just to think about the neshama during those days. I think we mentioned this last time, but since neither of you really got to hear the last call. So what's different? What do we do on Shabbos? On Shabbos, we get an extra soul. And that extra soul is meant to not just help us eat more dessert, which many people will say, you have a neshama yetera, you could have second helping, right? The neshama is actually not hungry for food, it turns out. It's hungry for Torah, it's hungry for connection, it's hungry for spirituality. So we get that second neshama to help us be able to mine the riches of Shabbos, of the spirituality that it has to offer, so that we could connect to it more deeply. There's so much extra Kedusha in Shabbos that we need an extra neshama piece in order to be able to absorb it. But at the end of Shabbos, that extra neshama leaves us. And for that reason, we smell the spices when we make Havdalah, right, to comfort the soul that's left behind because its soul companion is departing at the end of Shabbos. But at the end of Yontif, we don't smell spices. Right, the end of Yontif, we also, for Yontif, get an extra soul component, whatever that means. It's not actually an extra limb or anything, but something extra for our soul, and that stays with us. It doesn't depart. And so we don't smell spices at Havdalah at the end of Yontif because that extra Yontif soul just stays with us. It becomes integrated into us as we move into the rest of the year. So we have these like neshama rescue zones throughout the year, for our own personal spiritual rootedness and replenishment and growth. So we have that during the year. And then also we have times in history when there's more of a spiritual flow and more of a spiritual concealment, right, depending on where a person lives. I mean, whether you're living in a period of atheism enforced by the government or you're living in a period of atheism, let's just say even a 20-year-old living in a college dorm, right, is living in a period of atheism enforced by peer pressure. So it's uncomfortable for somebody living on most colleges' campuses in this country anyway to be able to say, even if they do believe in God, they might not say it out loud because it's embarrassing in that setting. Atheism is the cool thing, is the sophisticated thing, is the expected thing in left-wing college campuses. So there's different places that have less Kedusha and different places that have more. That's why one of the whole Kiruv things to do is scoop up those college students and bring them to Israel, right? Get them out of the dorm. Get them into the Holy Land where they can taste the Kedusha and feel it and hopefully bring some of that back, because we know that there are places with more and places with less, times with more and times with less, and activities with more and activities with less Kedusha. So all of that. So that's what this principle is talking about. So let's just reread inside the text. I'll start from the middle paragraph. There are many aspects and details involved in all this, all determined with the utmost precision according to what is most suitable for the rectification of creation as a whole. So we all need to go through what we're going through for the rectification of creation as a whole, but that includes higher and lower Kedusha zones. The particular sanctity surrounding certain special days as well as holy places is associated with this principle. In all these cases, a greater spiritual influence is extended to man, and he can attain more light, merit, and excellence according to predetermined degree. So I think that makes that more understandable. That's what's going on in these times and places. So, any question on that?
No, I think I'm clear.
Okay, good. And do you have any questions or thoughts on this? Okay, great. Great. So that brings us to the end of Chapter 8 in Section 2. And the next class then we'll start with Bezrat Hashem, with the soul, inspiration, and prophecy. So that's an interesting section. And I'll look forward to sharing that with you next week. Okay.
Lovely. So you're doing a later time next week?
So, all right, let's figure that out. Should we do a later time next week, or should we try this? I guess I would have to, are you going to be around?
When I'll be here, if I'm here, I can join.
Uh-huh.
I'm a board guest, so whatever works for you.
Okay, so I'm going to work, I'll try to use my phone today and experiment a little bit and see if I can make that work.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'll let you know by email. So if you don't hear, okay, Let's plan for this time next week. And if you,
mm-hmm,
if I do send out an email saying it's later, then we'll have it later next week.
Okay, lovely. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you. Nice to hear your voice.
Bye-bye.
Okay, yeah, feel awesome. Bye.